Hi, my name is Anya Viktorovich, and this is Rescue Radio by Portland Mountain Rescue.
Hi, friends. In this episode, I invited Eddie Cartaya, who is a PMR rescue leader. But instead of spending most of his time on a mountain, he spends it underneath the mountain in glacier caves. And that's what we'll be talking about today. In 2011, along with his friend Brent McGregor, Eddie surveyed and explored their first true glacier system and quickly discovered how these caves influence the life cycle of glaciers. Hi, Eddie.
Oh, hi, Anya.
Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks. Thank you for having me.
So can you introduce yourself to our listeners, please?
Yeah, sure. My name is Eddie Cartaya. I'm a rescue leader with Portland Mountain Rescue. I started with them in August of 2010. And a little bit of my background, I've got an aerospace engineering degree from West Point in 1990. I've been doing law enforcement most of my life, city law enforcement in Savannah, Georgia, and then federal law enforcement through the National Park Service and U.S. Forest Service for the last 21 years. Concurrent with that, I've been involved with technical rescue, mostly cave and alpine, since 1993. I've been involved with National Cave Rescue Commission since 1993. Mm-hmm. I'm a certified instructor. I've been a regional coordinator for the Pacific Northwest with them, national coordinator for the National Park Service Basic Technical Rescue Academy, and just, yeah, I've been caving, ice climbing, and doing things like that since, you know, the late 80s. I got exposed to the glacier cave aspect, which I think we're going to talk about today, starting about 2011. That's something that didn't really exist in the East, obviously, where I did most of my work. So that was something new to my experience when I moved here to the Pacific Northwest in 2010. But ever since that, I've just kind of immersed myself in that, the glaciology and the glacier cave aspect and the studies and just techniques, which are unique to this area, especially on our Pacific Northwest volcanoes. They create very unique environments, mm-hmm. that many people aren't aware of.
Yeah. And I know you wrote a book.
Oh, yeah. So a couple of years ago, as part of our work with Cave Rescue, myself and Rick Specht wrote, I think it's like 604 pages, a book on small party assisted rescue. And it's not just for Cave Rescue, but it focuses on lightweight, go-fast techniques for self-extrication or just hasty responses, basically doing a full-blown rescue using only the gear on your harness, mm-hmm. and lightweight equipment, which is particularly relevant in these types of projects where every ounce counts and you're having to move, you know, through very arduous terrain and be able to solve your own problem. There's no time for rescue coming from outside your team in most of these situations, just due to the nature of the environment.
It's a good book with a lot of good pictures and diagrams and explanations. I have it, so.
Oh, well, thank you.
Well, PMR is extremely lucky to have you and share your experience with us. So when I asked you to come over and talk about glacier caves, I actually said ice caves, and you corrected me that there are glacier caves. If you could tell me what the difference is.
Oh, yeah. So it's a real common misnomer. You see it actually in books and magazines as well. So an ice cave is just a regular rock cave, regardless of what it's made of, lava or limestone, that happens to have perennial ice packs in it. So ice formed. The cave itself is formed in rock, and then ice forms in it subsequent to its formation. Whereas a glacier cave is a void formed in the glacial ice mass, mm-hmm. itself. Mm-hmm. And that initially forms by way of water, be it liquid water flowing down in conventional glacier caves like Mount Hood, or in the form of steam as it occurs in fumaroles like in Mount St. Helens and Mount Rainier. And then once these little openings are opened, then airflow flows back and forth and very quickly exploits those openings to get very, very big. And then as the glacier mass flows, you know, plastic deformation, that's the third force that starts to open these passages and twist them around and make them, you know, very dynamic environments.
Thank you. Eddie, I know you go to a lot of expeditions into those caves with different scientists and agencies. Do you have a story about one of them that's a little bit more exciting than it should be?
So we have done many expeditions on those three mountains. The three main mountains is Hood, St. Helens, and Rainier. Mm. Mount Hood being the one we visited the longest because it was the ones we discovered first in 2011.
Oh, just recently, like 10 years ago.
Yeah, that was the first actual trip we made when we discovered it through the National Speleological Society. They quickly grew to large expeditions because there's a lot of science interest, a lot of different variety of scientists, mm-hmm. microbiologists, astrobiologists, glaciologists, all sorts, geochemists, because they're associated with volcanoes as well. So, yes, we've had many. Probably, I want to say I've been up there over 50 times to the Sandy Glacier, which is the part of the mountain you see from Portland. Mm-hmm. When you look at Mount Hood from Portland, you're looking actually right into the Sandy Glacier caves. In fact, one of our videos, we've done time lapse of Portland Airport from inside the cave, which is really, really cool. But as far as an exciting story goes, I mean, these are super high risk expert environments. So we try to plan ahead. It takes about a year to plan for these expeditions and come up with all the contingency planning and personnel. Portland Mountain Rescue always supplies a large number of people because we rely on alpinists to get the equipment up there and then to help keep our science staff safe. But glacier caves are always changing. They're completely unpredictable. Unlike a rock cave, once you map it, it doesn't change. These change daily, and from week to week, it becomes a completely different place. I think the story I'd share was our second expedition in 2013. Oregon Public Broadcast actually came up with us. The entrance to this relatively the newer cave called Pure Imagination was normally entered in from the bottom near the toe of the glacier. It was kind of a low fern. Fern is just metamorphic snow. It's snow that's turning into glacial ice, but it's not quite there yet. Low and wet, there's a lot of white water, very vigorous water flowing through these caves. When we showed up in 2013, we thought we could get in that way, but there had been a lot of snow, and the fern pack was a little thicker than we had anticipated. So we couldn't see that entrance, but a new shaft called a moulin had formed about 800 feet further up in elevation and maybe a 3/4 mile, further up the glacier. And that was open, a very big vertical shaft. Moulins are special kinds of glacial passage that transmit water from the surface of the glacier directly to the bedrock, the vertical in nature. So we did, we rigged our anchors. We got a team of 5 or 6 in there, and we left a team up top. We always carry in wire phones, cave rescue phones, and emergency equipment, and we stage it further down into the caves, or should there be a collapse, we still have communication with the team inside. But as soon as we got everybody down into the pit, the sun finally got to where it could shine onto the walls of the moulin. And all the little rocks that are embedded into the ice, because that's glaciers are formed largely with rocks as well that are just captured from the years prior, started to heat up and just kind of ooze their way out of the walls. Oh, so it became what we call like a rock faucet. Literally, the minute the sun hit it, showers of rocks started to come out and bounce down this ice shaft. So, and when you're on rope, you're very limited. You can't really dodge those except for a little bit left and right. So we were a little dismayed by that, but we had entered with the purpose of going out the bottom, so we didn't think of it too much of a big deal. So we proceeded down glacier in the cave. One big part is a waterfall pitch. We have to put ice screws in the wall and then get people down on rope through this it's a waterfall. The water is about 32.1 degrees Fahrenheit, so it's literally just a hair above freezing. Went all the way down to the bottom. Everyone got a little bit wet, but we figured we'd be out soon. And we get to the bottom, and all of a sudden, you see that the water just gets really low to the roof of the fern passage, and it would have been a belly crawl to proceed any further, which is suicide without dry suits, because you just can't stay immersed.
So cold.
Very, very, very cold. So at that time, we had this dilemma. We're thinking like, well, what do we do? No one really wanted to go back up the pit, the ice pit, because that's about 100 feet of rope climbing on ice with water and rocks showering down on you now, versus trying to dig out. Most of the group, I think four or five, decided to try and stay. And we anticipated we were maybe 8 feet below the surface of the glacier at that point. They began to dig straight up into the roof. So we left all of our shovels, ice axes, avalanche probes, and beacons. We always wear avalanche beacons underground because they work. Mm-hmm. You can actually track people from the surface with avalanche beacons under glacier caves up to 100 feet down.
Interesting.
So it's actually, you can keep very close track of where people are that way. However, we wanted a contingency. So myself, and I believe it was our geologist from Forest Service, we decided to leave and go way back up. And we braved the ice shaft. We had good rope climbing system. This is where caving rope climber systems really excel, because you can move very, very, very fast. And so one at a time, we just had to take the gamble, wait for things to get a little quiet, and climb up the rope as fast as we could. We both made it out without incident, but I can tell you that was a high-stress climb. I was climbing as fast as I possibly could.
Yeah.
It was definitely a sprint. I would say it's a sprint up 100 feet of rope with crampons, hoping you don't, getting hit with water. So you're soaked by the time you get out.
How experienced was the rest of the group?
A couple others in the group were experienced cavers, but not alpinists or glacier caving. I mean, in truth, if you ask, how many people are experienced at glacier caving, there's probably less than 24 in the world that could say yes. Thousands and thousands of experienced cavers. So that's what we had there. We had two or three other experienced cavers, but they were just not used to that type of environment.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason or another, they got cold and didn't feel like they wanted to risk climbing out on the ice shaft. Because if you do get stuck in a high-risk pitch like that in a moulin with rocks and water, the odds of a pickoff are slim to none. You probably wouldn't want to risk a second person.
Yeah.
Contingency anchors at that time, we would have just lowered you back down to get you out of the pitch.
Mm-hmm. So you made it to the top?
Yeah, so we did make it out to the top, and a number of us, including our PMR top staff there, went down glacier to the area roughly where we figured the Fern Cave entrance would be or was from the year before. We did have a GPS point, but that again, that's useless. It moves. The glacier. That's the problem. Your cave entrances travel every year, so GPS points are just guidelines. And we started looking, and luckily, unbeknownst to us, the team below had dug up into the ceiling about 6 feet and then pushed an avalanche probe, one of the long ones, about 300 centimeter ones, up through. And Mike Ochsner with our PMR, one of our other rescue leaders who was there, happened to notice the very tippy tip of the probe sticking up out of the snow, which is, rather unusual way to find an avalanche probe, but only about an inch of it sticking up.
Oh, wow.
And so good eyes on Mike. He saw it. So we grabbed it, tugged on it. We felt people tugging on it from the other side. So we, kicked it down so they'd know that we were starting to dig. So we began to dig from the top while they continued to dig from the bottom. I forget how long it took, but we had to switch out diggers. So, and going through fern is really hard. You had to chop a lot of ice. But we did finally make a visual connection about maybe 6 or 7 inches in diameter. And one of the members I remember was just kind of starting to get panic stricken with hyperthermia and tried literally pushing his face through the hole, just trying to get out. I think was maybe probably getting a little claustrophobic because you are hunkered down, stooped in, flooding passage with a fern snow over you. So we unfortunately had to literally push him back down. At one point, I think someone actually used their foot to kind of just say, you got to get back down so we can open this up and get people out. Pushed him back down. Then we did widen the hole enough to where we just barely fit someone. We had to wedge in a couple of ice axes into the walls to create a ladder and a little bit of a rope assist. And then we were able to extract the team from there. But yeah, so everybody got out, no injuries. The team coming out was definitely cold and wet, mm-hmm. a little hypothermic, kind of exciting.
But it ended well.
It ended well. And interestingly enough, by the end of that week, that hole just from the airflow was big enough to be about 2 meters in diameter. So it was, that's how rapid, you know, airflow changes those types of things.
Mm-hmm. So at the beginning, you mentioned that Glacier Cave is an expert area. Can you elaborate?
Yeah. You know, mountains themselves, once you're on a glacier, obviously you've got a whole set of hazards that, you know, glacier travelers are already aware of. You got crevasses and rockfall and things of that nature, avalanche in certain times of the year. But once you go under the ice itself, there's a host of hazards that are not necessarily intuitive and can be deadly. So I would say I'll list the three top ones, especially in these kinds of caves. The reason the sandy glacier caves exist where they are and not really anywhere else on Mount Hood is because there's several dozen hot springs in there. They're not hot as in you would make a hot tub out of it, but you know, compared to 31 degree water, they might be 79, 80 degrees. And that rises the temperature of the air in the cave to be above freezing. So it's actually not a freezing environment per se in the air, but warm air rises and it goes to the ceiling and the walls and it starts to contact rocks that are exposed hanging in the ice. And it starts to heat up those rocks and flow around the rocks and it gradually melts them out to where it'll rain rock. Anywhere from a golf ball size to the size of a smart car.
Wow.
So as you travel through the caves, you have to be cognizant of overhead hazards and not just where they would impact, but since the whole cave is sloped, of the roll path it would take.
Mm-hmm.
So as we move scientists and folks through the cave, we actually have to flag routes that avoid overhead hazards and roll paths that these boulders would take coming down. And sometimes that means getting into the water, into white water, rapids.
Oh, wow.
So that has to be belayed. Mm-hmm. The other one is delamination. You know, glaciers form in layers. And when you go in there, you can actually see and count the seasons. You see little thin ash layers. That's where the dirt and ash right before the next winter's snow was entombed by the winter snow.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like rings of a tree. You can actually count layers. But when warm air rises in those caves, it also gets into those ash layers, heats them, and it starts to cut little slices out of the ceiling. And it can be like a giant diving board of ice over your head that you can't really tell unless you look for it, the sagging. And whole sections of the roof can just come crashing down without warning. So you'll see this. You'll see big places of beautiful ice laying on the floor, and it unfortunately draws inexperienced people right to it because mm-hmm. it's beautiful and people want to go handle the ice. But that's exactly where you don't want to be. Mm-hmm. So when you see the ice on the floor, those are areas of delamination impact. You have to steer well around those.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the third one we've also had some close calls with are glacial outbursts. Most glaciers hold tremendous amounts of water, sometimes in hydrostatic dams. You know, there's big bodies of water that are contained inside the glacier. There's also, you know, basically the aquifers and streams that flow through it. And periodically, those can get dammed up.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, they just break and release huge amounts of water that then go crashing through the tunnel. And as they do so, they push rock fronts in front of them. So it'll be like a bulldozer of rocks and boulders. You can actually hear, we've witnessed them. I've had some near misses with them. You can actually hear it like a freight train coming. Right behind this wave of rocks is a bunch of muddy water that's trying to pass through.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the, you know, kind of a strange precaution we take is we always take ice screws just for rigging, but also a tether to your harness at all times. Because, you know, should that happen, one of the things you can, really about all you can, you're never going to outrun it, is to, you know, put an ice screw in the wall, the ceiling, and clip to it.
And hope for the
and
best.
And just hope, yeah, at least you don't get swept downstream with it. So, yeah, those are, and there's yucca loops, I believe is how they're referred to in Europe. And some of them can be huge. We've had actually hikers in the Mount Hood area swept away. A couple of them have perished because of that, because the flood leaves the glacier, goes downstream, and eventually intersects trail crossings.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very real hazard that occurs around glaciers, but particularly so when you're inside the glacier with it, because there's nowhere to run when a tidal wave comes down the tube at you. So I'd say, you know, that's just an example of some of the things, you know, the average alpinist or climber wouldn't think about into caves like this. Aside, you know, and then other ones like volcanoes have hazardous air, CO2 and hydrogen sulfide. You know, Mount Hood is a hydrogen sulfide volcano. So we have to be cognizant. We always carry gas monitors and escape rebreathers with us just in case.
Oh, those are things I've never thought about. And I know a lot of people go into the caves.
Yeah.
So can you describe how it is to be in the cave? It must be different environment.
As I've told people before, you know, it's both, I guess, terrifying and awe-inspiring. There's really no indication on the surface of the environment you're about to enter, because the snow and ice is a very good insulator for sound and heat. So it may be very warm on the surface. You're sweating. You got glacier glasses, and then you get on rope. And as you rappel into these huge chambers, there's deafening white water crashing through. Then you start to hit the cold air. And once you're down there, you can just hear and feel rocks rolling around. So it's just a very, you feel very small, and you definitely feel like you're a limited time intruder in there. It's like, it's not a place you should linger or hang out for fun. We go in there primarily to study with scientists and map them and learn what we can from the glacier by way of studying it from inside out. But it is beautiful, and it's very invigorating, energy-wise, to enter these places. It's like a dangerous beauty, like looking at a tornado or an avalanche or something like that. It's a very powerful force of nature. It's extremely dynamic. You're aware that the ice is moving, the water's moving, there's rocks falling, airflow. You're aware of the waves that move through there. So yeah, it's exhilarating, but at the same time, there's a stress level that stays with you. It's a sustained level of stress the entire time you're in there, because it's an environment that is just fraught with hazards. And if you don't respect it even for a second, you could, you know, be hurt very badly with it.
How many ice caves were discovered on Mount Hood so far, do you know?
On Mount Hood, we've had three named caves. Snow Dragon was the very first one discovered. Hikers used to go to it.
Yeah.
We mapped it and named it. Brent McGregor and Scott Lynn with Corvallis Mountain Rescue and myself found it in 2011 and gave it that name. Mm. That name is comes from some avalanche texts, actually, from Bruce Tremper's avalanche book about the sleeping dragon under the snow that people don't often think about in terms of the waiting avalanche. And this was definitely, you know, reminiscent of that, because you would have no clue that something this huge and vast was under your feet if you're crossing the Sandy Glacier.
How did you find it?
Again, through YouTube videos. Some hiking clubs would hike periodically to the entrance and take photos.
Mm-hmm.
There was really no record or GPS points, and we just became aware of it, and we hiked out one July of 2011 and found it in a crevasse. We actually had to enter a crevasse, traverse through it, and it opened up into this massive borehole, and that's how we found it. Mm-hmm. It had never been mapped or explored, so we did it on that trip. A few weeks later, Brent went back to take photos and found an adjacent tube, which he subsequently named Pure Imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that's become the biggest, the longest, and the most complex cave up there. But I think within a year, we also found a third one called Frozen Minotaur. That was given its name because of its labyrinth pattern. It wasn't just a straight tube or a couple of branches. It was very complex. A reference to the mythological creature, the Minotaur. It was, you know, called the Frozen Minotaur. Snow Dragon has mostly receded and been destroyed by glacial recession. Mm-hmm. I'd say Frozen Minotaur, only about 30% of it is left.
Mm-hmm.
However, Pure Imagination continues to persist. As it loses passage on the toe, it keeps propagating new passage further and further up. Because, you know, in truth, glacier caves like this are part of the thermodynamic process mm-hmm. of glacier recession. So it will continue to maintain these caves.
How big are they? Like, how many feet are we talking about?
It was well over a mile of surveyed passage when we surveyed it, when all these were connected. They've since been somewhat segmented. So I'd say each section's at this point just, you know, I haven't seen a recent survey of it. I'd say a couple thousand feet. Maybe half a mile at best for pure imagination. If you count all the passage, it's still there. Mm-hmm. But it was at one time over a mile of interconnected passages. And again, it's constantly changing every year. That's why we have to survey it every year.
Oh, that's huge. How do you prepare for expeditions like this? Because, I mean, it's such a hazardous area.
Yeah, no, it is. And first of all, you have to come prepared to handle your own problems because we all know mountain weather is very unpredictable. Cannot always rely on a helicopter just to come and bail you out. And even a ground team to get up there, it's a long approach on foot. And then it's kind of precarious traversing, getting over the rocks, the boulders, the glacier itself. When we do these trips, there's a lot of planning that goes into it in terms of just contingencies. We always have medical staff on board. We bring our own rescue team and equipment. So there's always a litter, ropes that we use for, you know, access, but we've got them double purposed for rescue. The SPAR, the book that you referred to earlier in the program, Small Party Assisted Rescue, that really is the underlying rescue philosophy that we use because we just don't have the manpower and the means to carry a full-blown rescue kit up there. We're using 8 or 9 millimeter ropes. You know, you develop your redundancy by way of internally engineering it versus two of everything. You're just almost never going to have, you know, two rope systems on things like this.
Right.
But you still need to be safe. And then just interviewing your members, making sure they're properly equipped with clothes. A lot of people are not aware of what it takes to operate and study and work underground in glaciers. You've got to have, you know, multiple lights in your helmet, not just one. A lot of us, you know, carry different gas monitors, lasers on our helmets to indicate overhead hazards or CO2, you know, layers. Mm-hmm. So just a lot of specialty equipment, sat phones. Obviously, we're all wearing avalanche beacons, even though you're underground. Actually, in truth, in the winter, avalanches will enter these caves and flow both uphill and downhill inside the tubes. So you could actually have avalanche burials inside the caves.
Wow.
So you guys got to be prepared for all of these sorts of things.
So you also have to train the scientists how to behave in an environment like this?
Very often, actually, I'd say most of the time, they come early. And if they have never been in there before, we do offer them some training. You know, a lot of them have never even done ice axe arrest or worn crampons.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we have to just simply get them fitted and trained in the very, you know, mountaineering 101, just how to get there. And then the aspects inside the cave, they're always attended to by a rescue staff personnel, which is, you know, why PMR and volcano rescue team, we have folks like that always there with attached to a science team. Mm-hmm. And their specific function is to look for the overhead hazards, to listen up for water changes, because the science teams are there focused on their science objectives. And they're very, you know, they're using instruments and things like that. So you can't bank on them being aware.
They're probably distracted looking for things.
Exactly. They're there to get their objectives. Our job is to protect them from the environment so that they can get their objectives safely.
Wow, interesting. So what are the scientists looking for?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's actually, I guess the answer, it's a multifaceted study. There's a lot of scientists with different disciplines. They come out because this is, in a large part, this is one of the closest analogies to ice bodies or places where life could live and other ice bodies in the solar system. So there's a big interest from astrobiologists who specialize in studying extremophiles. These are organisms that live out of sunlight with no traditional way to make food. A lot of them, you know, survive off gases that are, you know, being exuded through fumaroles, or they break down rock to get their nutrients from that. So it's a good way for those kinds of microbiologists, and we have quite a number of them from local universities as well as NASA and Jet Propulsion Laboratory come out to not just study those organisms, but to design collection devices for ice rovers that are going to hopefully that are being designed to go to these other ice bodies, whether it's the Martian ice caps or Enceladus, ice moons, things of that nature, to test how these rovers can move in such an environment and then make these collections. Another aspect is just geochemistry, the gases that come out either through a gas fumarole or by way of water that's bubbling up where it's been infused with some magmatic gases. That can tell you a lot about the volcano itself, and then also airflow, how air flows through these caves. That's a big factor, and how they form, how it carries warm air from one part of the cave to the other. It's a big rescue concern because if there's, toxic gases, that can also be transported from one place to another. So it's something we want to note in rescue. If these, obviously volcanoes, most of them are being monitored seismically for future activity, and they start to shake, the USGS will be the first to know about it. Mm-hmm. But there's other ways that volcanoes can exhibit changes in behavior, and a lot of that subtly through, maybe increase in fumarole emissions, which can be monitored very slowly by watching expansions in the ice tubes or rises or falls in glacial lakes underground. So our hope is to eventually be able to associate changes in the geomorphology or the shape or geometry of the caves and the volume of the fumaroles and the lakes with volcanic activity. Perhaps that could someday be used to predict or see, future volcanic behavior, maybe a slight early warning system or a way to augment, other different kinds of observations. Because there's things you just can't observe. A lot of glaciology is done by satellite from the surface, but to actually go under and inside the glacier, you actually learn a lot by watching it. And then glaciology itself, you can see the surface of a glacier and you can watch it recede from a satellite, but what you can't really see is how it's gutting itself out or losing mass from the inside out. Every, drop of water you see coming out of these glaciers is a piece of the ice that's leaving. From year to year, compare volumes in the cave maps and, determine, ice mass lost. So it's a very interesting way of studying the anatomy and physiology of the glaciers from deep inside of them. So we call these integrated studies because it's not a singular discipline. Like if you're studying a lake, you don't just study the fish or just the underwater plants or just the chemistry of the water. You study them all together so that you understand how each reacts to the other within context of each other. And that's why we have so many scientists with so many different backgrounds, and it's really awesome to talk to these folks because they're brilliant and they're really dedicated to do that kind of work in such a hostile environment. So it's really been an honor to work with those guys.
It's really fascinating. How often do you go?
Oh, every year. We go to Mount Hood at least twice a year. St. Helens is usually once a year, sometimes twice. That one's helicopter support. It's one of the few we can use helicopter to get some logistics in and out. Mount Rainier was every year. It's been, I believe, 3 years since we've been up there. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping to get back up and check on things. That's the most stable of the three in terms of changes. Mm-hmm. So you can afford to skip a year or two sometimes up on the Mount Rainier. But definitely every year we're doing this, and we have mountain rescuers involved in all of them.
Seems like they're slowly disappearing too, so you kind of want to learn as much as you can.
Yeah, that's interesting. So we actually, of the three caves, we actually have an example of each. So we have one of the most rapidly receding glaciers, the Sandy Glacier is one. And then we have one of the polar opposite, which is the Mount St. Helens Crater Glacier is one of the most rapidly advancing glaciers. It's growing leaps and bounds.
Interesting.
And then you have the perfect balance one on Mount Rainier, where it's almost in stasis. It seems to be melting at the base just as fast as it accumulates at the top, which is an interesting thing. glaciers are paleoclimate archives. You can study a lot about how climate changes with them, but they have, you know, like, I guess, say thermodynamic momentum. Like right now, even if an ice age were to hit, the Sandy Glacier would still recede for a little bit until it caught up and started to grow again. The same thing for St. Helens. There's momentum to those movements, whereas Rainier is like a scale completely in balance. So if you have a scale totally in balance, you can drop a pin on one side and it'll throw the scale off.
Yeah.
So it's very sensitive versus something like St. Helens, where you have, you know, 10 bricks on one side and a feather on the other. It would take a lot of change to register a change of behavior in that glacier.
Who do you work with, and do you have people coming from different countries?
Oh, yeah. That's actually been one of the most rewarding aspects of these expeditions and these studies, is because of the international involvement. So from the science arena, we have a large contingency that comes from Germany. Dr. Andreas Flitsch leads the climatology and the geomorphology aspect of these studies and wind flow studies. He comes with a number of folks from there. We just recently had a Romanian volcanologist for the Mount St. Helens study. We've had a number of surveyors and cavers coming in from Canada. They do a lot of the mapping work after the expeditions are over. So yeah, quite an interesting spread of folks from those places. And then, you know, the other half that's really interesting from the mountain rescue perspective is all the different teams supply, you know, people to help with these. You know, obviously Portland Mountain Rescue has been heavily involved from the beginning because Mount Hood's our mountain. But we've had, you know, teams from Crag Rats, a Volcano Rescue, several from Colorado, Alpine, Rocky Mountain Rescue, all the ones up in Seattle. We've had cave groups from the Shasta area grotto, the Deschutes County Mountain Rescue right there in Bend where I live. So it's been a kind of a grassroots effort to support this because, A, we need it, and it's a chance for a lot of these teams to get experiences they wouldn't otherwise get. Again, these are, and really in truth, the more mountain rescuers we have exposed to these environments and getting some comfort level with them, that we're actually building a cache of responders that it won't be their first time in there should an incident ever happen. So we are actually building an area, you know, contingency by having people trained and experienced to handle operations. Albeit, you know, we haven't had a rescue occur, but, you know, rescue, just to be good at a rescue in an environment, you need to be fluid at that environment. And if you are, then everything else is pretty traditional.
Are you aware of other glacier caves in other countries, in other parts of the world?
Oh, yes. There's definitely other, you know, Alaska definitely has some, you know, Europe, you know, the huge glaciers up there, Nagorno-Grat. There's definitely glacier cave projects up there. There's teams that similar to ours that operate in those areas. Obviously, Antarctica has a whole series of glacier caves formed, you know, through funeral processes up there near Mount Erebus and places like that, the Soviet Union. So yeah, there definitely are other places that have some glacier caves, but really the extent of them, and just in terms of mileage in survey, really don't come close to the lengths of the ones we have here.
Wow.
So it's really been interesting. That's not to say they don't exist, because there are so many glaciers that have not been explored. You know, Alaska certainly has vast glaciers. There could be something there. We know Mount Baker right here close by has got some. We just haven't been in there. There's a lot of gas hazards and work with the land management agencies, National Park Service, U.S. Forest Service. You have to observe their wilderness permitting restrictions. So there's a lot of paperwork and process to go into getting these things, not just done safely, but done legally. It's definitely, you know, you want to maintain good working relationships with these, who the stewards of the land are. But yeah, for sure, there's others in many other countries. And yeah, that's something to look forward to in the future. I think it'd be neat to expand these studies for sure. Canada, I know recently, our Christian Stenner, one of our surveyors, we started doing work in Mount Meager there in British Columbia just a couple of years ago. So that's a new project. They're going back to recon it again this year. So we'll be doing a lot more work up in that Canadian glacier cave system.
How many caves are on St. Helens and on Mount Rainier?
So yeah, we just now returned from actually the biggest Mount St. Helens glacier cave expedition. End of June. I forget the exact length because our surveyors are still putting the data together, but I believe it is now the second longest glacial volcanic cave system in the world, with I believe Mount Rainier is the first. So on St. Helens, there's actually, I think, five named cave systems. And on Rainier, there's really two, but they're long. So you got the East Crater and the West Crater. You have two craters on Mount Rainier, each with its own summit ice pack. These cave systems are deep inside the craters. They're radial. They have like spokes. And then near the bottom, there's a master tube, a lake. You know, Lake Adeli exists up there, which is a beautiful subglacial lake, which we discovered in, I believe, 2014. And then the West Crater has a smaller system, which unfortunately has a lot of CO2 in it. So two systems up there, which collectively are the longest glacier cave, volcano glacier cave systems in the world.
Any advice for our listeners before we finish?
I guess one thing that we saw, if I had to put a message out to people, after OPB did their shows up there, there was a huge surge in visitation from tourists. And obviously, when you look at the pictures, these are just beautiful, beautiful places.
Yeah.
So you can't fault people for wanting to go and experience them in person. But again, the hazards just can't be overemphasized. While we've been up there for years following, we've seen people, in tennis shoes, t-shirts, whole families standing under the drip line the cave. So, another thing I didn't really talk about, frequently the most dangerous part about the caves is getting into them, because there's rocks lined up at the entrances. And if you think of an archway of a passage where the water would drip off of it and hit the ground underneath it, that's called the drip line. And you can tell former drip lines of these caves every year because there's little monuments, piles of rocks that have all slid down and made these monuments there. So that's exactly where you don't want to stand. It's right at the entrance of the cave. It's the most dangerous. You want to stay far away from the entrance or get really far into it. And so we see people sledding down the glacier, having fun, taking family photos right at the drip line. Going in without helmets, using a cell phone as their light.
Unaware.
Yeah, completely clueless as to what's going on in there. And, our worst fear is having a rescue occur. It's less of, not that it would be good, but at least when we're there, if an accident happens, we're prepared. We have a whole rescue team. We have doctors. We have rescue staff already there. If this happens to a tourist or a visitor, or a skier who wanders in out of curiosity and they get hurt, the odds of a rescue getting there in time to save them is slim, because the hypothermia, once you're immobile in a cave like this, hypothermia takes hold. And with 32 degree water, it takes no time at all to die of exposure, or experience, any of these rocks hit you, it's not going to be survivable in most cases.
Right. And if it collapses, you have to dig them out of ice, right?
Out of ice. Yeah. Which is a mechanical saw type thing. And that's if you survive it.
Yeah.
I would say, if people are interested in these caves, look at the photos, the videos. It's just not all environments are safe for people to enter an experience, or if you are interested, get involved with one of these expeditions or teams that go in with professionals that know how to manage and mitigate those hazards. But that is a concern. Even on the other mountains like Rainier, there's whole guide groups are led over the entrances to the caves at the summit ice blocks, summit ice caps there. They don't even know that if they break through, they're going to fall a long, long ways in and then land in CO, carbon dioxide lakes, which could asphyxiate you very, very quickly. Or a lot of times they go into the caves just to take shelter in storms, especially on Rainier. Big wind storms, or tent blows away, or they summit later than they thought. So they go into the caves. Mm-hmm. And while they're waiting, they start exploring, again, not realizing that there's invisible hazards like gas lakes and things like that, where if you start getting into them, the symptoms of CO2 poisoning, unfortunately, replicate high altitude exhaustion. Mm-hmm. So you're already breathing hard and feeling, you know, pretty poor, for most people are when they're summiting Rainier. And so they wouldn't become necessarily start associating symptoms of CO2 with an invisible threat that they mm-hmm. were not aware of. So a lot of these missions, the purpose of them is to make rescue pre-planning maps where you actually plot where these CO2 lakes are, where some of the hazards are, where staging areas would be for litters. If we did have a rescue in there for complex caves, we put markers so that they can be associated with rescue teams, because likely whoever's going in there to do rescues is not us. Mm-hmm. It'd be nice if we were there, but we have to make these maps so that they're usable and functional for mm-hmm. surface mountain rescue teams. And then hopefully, you know, getting more people trained in how to do SPAR type rescues, because you just don't have the manpower and the means, or even, you know, it wouldn't really even be wise to bring a lot of heavy apparatus and multiple mm-hmm. ropes into these free hanging drops with water mm-hmm. that could, you know, spin the little ropes around and tie people up. So mm-hmm. yeah, a lot of different things to think about, but I'd encourage the public, you know, if they go into these things, to do so from a distance or get with someone, you know, that's been there before. Just take it very, very seriously.
Yeah, I know that people have died on Mount Hood in the caves.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And collapses. We've had, yeah. Collapses.
Eddie, thank you so much for coming over and really sharing this fascinating information about glacier caves. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. Really, it was fun.
And that's all we have for you today. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please visit our website at pmru.org. You can also find us on Facebook under Portland Mountain Rescue, or Instagram also under Portland Mountain Rescue. And if you want to show us some love, hit that subscribe button. A huge thank you and shout out to our editor Murray Feher for making my life easy and making me sound good. Until next time.